Good afternoon. I'm thrilled to see this turnout here. I didn't really know what to expect. So welcome, everybody. My name is Len Wyatt. I'm a program manager at Microsoft in Redmond in the database organization. You probably think of us as the SQL Server organization, but we now do big data as well. So to start out with, I'd like to get a little bit of a feel for what people in the audience actually know about big data today. So is anybody actually running a big data system or a Hadoop cluster or anything like that? There's one. Okay. That's all right. That's not surprising. So how many people are like kicking the tires and trying it out? Or are you in production or are you actually kicking the tires right now? Sorry, what? In production, great, okay. So are there people kind of kicking the tires and trying things out? Couple, three, okay. So I'm guessing there's a lot of people who have been reading about Hadoop and big data. So how many people have been reading about it and are aware of the substantial hype in the marketplace? Yeah, okay, lots of people in that camp. Who's never heard of it before? How many people, this is your first exposure to big data? A few? All right. And who hasn't raised their hand yet? All right. I won't ask what that means. Okay, that gives me a pretty good idea of where everybody's starting from. So as it turns out, I've been working in relational databases, and particularly data warehousing and business intelligence for quite a while. And in the last, number of months, I've made this journey, to kind of having this split personality where I'm, in the big data world part of the time and in the relational world part of the time. And in the process, I've learned some things that I think were pretty important lessons that I'd like to try and share with you folks today and hopefully ease your journey as you go into the big data area. So what we'll do today is we'll start with just a few words about why all the fuss about big data. Why all this hype? Why all the excitement about big data? And then we'll talk about what Hadoop is, both structurally, like what it's made of, and from an ecosystem point of view. What are the tools and things that come with the Hadoop ecosystem? And then we'll talk a little bit about how Hadoop compares with a relational database environment. And I think that's pretty instructive when you think about the similarities and the differences, so you understand which of the things will still apply in the new world. So we'll look both from an architectural point of view and from a tooling point of view at some of the differences between these two worlds. We'll talk a little bit about NoSQL. We hear a lot of talk about NoSQL, no schema, and things like that. We'll talk a little bit about what that means in practice. And I'll give some general guidance about what Microsoft is doing in the big data space. I will say right up front, I'm not making any product announcements today. So if you were hoping for that, I'm sorry to disappoint you. But there are some things that Microsoft always does, and maybe I can help you think about what that means in the big data space. And we'll end with just a few words about building the skills to work in this environment. What are some of the things you'd need to know in the big data area? So why all this fuss about big data? We've all heard of the data explosion, right? There's a lot of hype just about the data explosion. And we all know it's true. Our businesses and our organizations have more data every day that we have to deal with. So just the sheer volume of data is one thing that drives the interest in the big data area. The other thing, though, and I should say when I'm talking about data, just the data volume issue, and we're kind of talking about data of types that we're familiar with, which is still basically organized, structured data. Now, that might appear as any number of formats. It might be CSV files, but if you think about a CSV file, it still kind of has a schema about it. You know what each column means in a CSV file. So when I just sheer data volume, one way of looking at it is more of the kind of stuff that you could put in a relational database today. But the other kind of thing that we want to think about is varieties of data, and in particular, unstructured data. You know, if you're trying to do sentiment analysis based on Twitter feeds or based on email exchanges, that's not relational data. It isn't now, it never was, and it never will be relational data. That kind of textual data needs a different set of tools. And those tools also appear in the ecosystem of the big data tools. So I think those are the two main trends that drive this interest in big data. So volume and variety, and you'll also hear people talk about velocity, the movement of data. But I think volume and variety are the real two drivers, especially in the decision support, data warehousing, business intelligence areas. Now, in theory, big data would be bigger than Hadoop. Big data is a general term. It's kind of a nebulous term. And it should mean more than the specific implementation of Hadoop. But in practice, almost everybody who's talking about big data these days is talking about the Hadoop ecosystem that comes from the open source community. It started with the web properties and has just exploded. So the way I put it, in practice, big data is roughly the same thing as Hadoop. It's not exactly the same thing, but most of the time when you hear about big data in the marketplace, hear people's hype, they're really talking about Hadoop. Hadoop is a rapidly changing ecosystem. What's true today is different than what was true a month ago, and it's going to change again by next month. It's amazing how fast stuff is happening. And a lot of this is because of the open source community that's driving it. New contributions and new ideas are coming in all over the place. And this is good. We like that. It's also sometimes kind of confusing as you don't know how to react to all this. There are a lot of components in the big data ecosystem, and there's a lot of vendors. Everybody's rushing in. It's like a gold mine mentality right now, with people rushing in trying to get their offerings out in the big data space. There's a lot of change, and you need to be prepared for that as you step into the big data area. So let's now focus on Hadoop specifically and ask the question, what is Hadoop, inside? And at its core, there's two essential things in Hadoop. There's the Hadoop Distributed File System, HDFS, and there's MapReduce. So on this slide, we'll start with a super, super high-level introduction to HDFS. So if I imagine a giant file, if we think of that file as being broken up into a whole lot of blocks, and in HDFS, I believe a block is 128 megabytes, those blocks will be distributed out to different nodes in my cluster. So a node is just it's a computer, and it's got a bunch of disks on it, and all these nodes together make up the cluster with one node called the name node that's kind of like the traffic director. Actually, that's what's a traffic director, but it's the node that knows where everything is. So any given block of the file typically will be distributed to three different nodes in the cluster. So if I look, for example, at this kind of, what is that, kind of yellow-orange node here, this yellow-orange block here, there's a copy of that written onto this node, and this node, and this node. And the next block of that file, the black one, is written onto this node, and that one. So when the data is distributed like that, one thing that can happen is you can start to execute parallel algorithms because you can get things going on all these different nodes. But the other thing that happens is that you've got your fault tolerance. Your reliability is built into the system because the data is replicated on multiple nodes. So no one node is a point of failure. And what that means is that you can start to use cheaper hardware. You don't have to have the best enterprise-grade servers. You don't have to have mirrored disks and all these things. People just put out, you know, big farms of cheap computers, and they've got high reliability built in through the software infrastructure. So the distributed file system is one of the core components of Hadoop. And there's a lot more to it than what I've said here, but that, you know, as a 50,000-foot view, think of parallelism and reliability as the reasons for wanting to do this distributed file system. Then the second core piece of Hadoop is called MapReduce. And MapReduce is really a programming paradigm. It's a way of doing distributed programming, parallel programming over a distributed collection of computers. Basically, the idea is that you want to divide a big problem into a bunch of small ones. And in this context, the small problems are the work that you do on each block of data of all the blocks of data in your file. So however many blocks of data you've got, that's how many map jobs are going to be created. And you'll distribute the work out to the servers where the data is. You don't bring the data into a central server. You distribute the computation work out to the node. So all this computation work gets distributed out to the nodes, but now you've got pieces of the problem being solved all over the place. And so there's a second phase of operation called the reduce phase, where all that data is shuffled between the nodes and brought together and recombined by reducer tasks to create the final output of the MapReduce job. So it is a programming paradigm. And I'm not actually much of a programmer. I really don't know much about Java. I assume that's probably true of most of you folks too. So I'm actually not going to talk much about this slide, except to say that what you see here is some code, and it defines the map function and the reduce function. And the rest of how all this gets executed is left up to Hadoop. To the MapReduce system. It's a set of Java libraries that know how to distribute the work out to all these machines. So a developer writes a map job and a map task and a reduce task. These get put together, executed in the framework, and magic happens. You get results. But as IT folks, we don't want to write MapReduce jobs. I know I don't want to write MapReduce jobs. And I know even at a place like Facebook, where they run 70,000 MapReduce jobs a day, 98% of them were actually created in Hive, which is a higher level tool on top of MapReduce. They're not written as MapReduce jobs. So we've got this as kind of our contextual understanding of what's going on. But now let's go on and talk about the tools that you'll actually use in day-to-day practice most of the time. So as a complete ecosystem, there's a bunch of things in here. I'm not going to try and read everything on this slide, but you can see that you've got your distributed storage layer, HDFS, you've got your distributed processing layer, MapReduce, and then you've got a query language called Hive up here, which is a way of writing remarkably SQL-like queries that run against the underlying data. You've also got a scripting language, Pig. Oops, what happened to my pointer? There it is. So we've got the scripting language, Pig, where you can do set-based operations on your data. You've got workflow tools like Uzi. And what happens is all the things that we do today in decision support and data warehousing, business intelligence, they're kind of being replicated in this ecosystem, right? We've got to manage workflows, and if you use SSIS, you do that as a task flow in your SSIS jobs. We've got to manage data flows, and again, if you're using SSIS, that's the data flow, which is one of the tasks in your workflow. We write queries, and here we write queries using Hive. So a lot of the things that you already know and the things that you know you need to do on a day-to-day basis need to be done here too. But there is a different set of tooling that comes into play when you're managing these clusters and running a framework that's based on the on a MapReduce environment. But I really want to emphasize the core functions: data movement, data integration, having a query interface, having database services should be really familiar to all of you. So today we're going to talk, we've already talked a little bit about HDFS. We're going to talk some more about Hive and Pig, but in a 1 hour session we really can't cover the whole ecosystem. There are other parts of the ecosystem that we won't be able to talk about today, and I'll just mention some of them briefly because you might want to look some of these things up. Scoop is a data transfer tool for sending data between Hadoop and relational databases, either direction. And so as you start to integrate Hadoop into your existing infrastructure, Scoop is a tool that you will probably want to be using. HCatalog is a metadata services layer that sits underneath Pig and Hive, so you don't have to continually deal with metadata issues and schema issues. HBase is a NoSQL database. It's meant for what the open source community thinks of as transaction processing. Now, when that community is talking about transaction processing, they're probably talking about the transactions that are behind a website or something like that. At least in my mind, I wouldn't want to go run my bank on HBase. It's a different kind of animal. It's not an ACID database. But it is a transactional database in a different sense and is a useful tool for some applications. I think I mentioned Oozie, which is a workflow management tool. You know, I've got to get my data ingestion done before I do my synthetic operate or my synthesis operations to reduce that data and transform it into something else. And Oozie manages the steps in the flow of work. Flume is a commonly referenced data ingestion tool. Think of it as being a little bit analogous to SSIS for bringing data in from the outside world and getting that into the HDFS environment. And the list goes on. There's all these quirky names, you know, animal names. Mahout, it turns out, is in India, Mahout is the guy who rides an elephant, I guess. But in this ecosystem, Mahout is a machine learning tool, a data mining language. So this goes on and on. It's a very fast-changing area. But these are some of the key things that you'd want to look at. These are kind of the core pieces of Hadoop. So it's demo time. And I have good news and bad news. I've got a really cool demo. The bad news is it doesn't work today. it turns out that I made a very bad judgment call, and a few days before I got on the airplane, I took a new build. It broke my environment, and I didn't have time to get everything fixed. But you will benefit from my prior experience. I have had demo disasters before. And so I knew enough before I took the new build to do a screenshot capture of my entire demo. So we're going to do a screenshot demo instead of a live demo. My apologies for that, but at least you'll know it really did work last week. So, whoops, sorry. Let's go back here. So these are screenshots that I captured last week as I walked through this demo in my office. Now, the first thing is, despite everything that I just said about the Hadoop Distributed File System, HDFS, as the underlying store, it turns out that there's actually an abstraction layer in there, and HDFS is the default store, but you can put other kinds of storage in there. And that's important because one of the things that you'll hear me talk about in a little while is the fact that Microsoft is making a cloud-based offering of Hadoop. And this demo is actually based on our cloud-based offering. So that abstraction layer is really crucial One of the things you'll want to do when you're operating in a cloud context is use cloud storage instead of HDFS, because that means that you only pay to store the data and you don't have to pay to keep your cluster alive when you're not using it. So you can keep your data stored in Azure storage in the cloud, and your Hadoop cluster, which is also in the cloud, you can let go of. So you're not paying for it. You just keep the data around. And then when you want to run more jobs, you reinstantiate the cluster and run your jobs. You know, you can just own that cluster for as long as you need to. I guess I should say rent the cluster for as long as you need to. So this is a screenshot of the management console. It's just a web application for Windows Azure. And you can see there's database services, which is basically SQL Server in the cloud. There's data sync services, and there's data storage services. So I've actually got three storage accounts, and there's one, the one that's highlighted here in the middle, I've got a movie database in there. And it's, so I've created this container, this container in the cloud where I can put arbitrary data. Then on my computer at work, I had this data that I wanted to upload into the cloud. And I used this thing called the Azure Storage Explorer, which lets me connect to my store in the cloud. I can create different containers. So here I've got a container with for users' data. And then I put one file in this container, which I just took a CSV file that had my user data, and I uploaded it into the cloud. So this is a tool that's really useful, by the way, if you're doing some testing, you want to try things out, just get some data up there, or maybe for your initial one-time load of the system. This probably isn't the tool you'd use for ongoing, you know, daily updates in the cloud. You want to do something more automated for that. But for one-off use, this is a really nice tool. Then I went and set up a cloud cluster. This is called the Hadoop on Azure service, and it's in preview, so you can sign up for previews and experiment with Hadoop on Azure today. And after I instantiated the cluster, this is the first screen that I got. And what I did was I went over, I clicked on Manage Cluster, and then I set up a link to my ASV storage, my Azure storage volume. So there's that movie database that I have stored up in the cloud. I gave it my passkey. I guess don't look. And that was it. Now I've connected Azure storage to my Hadoop cluster. And then now that storage is accessible in my cluster just like any other file would be. As long as I put ASV colon in front of it, then I can give the path to my data. Now, what I'm showing on this screen is actually a script for the PIG tool. And you'll never, does anybody know what the language for PIG is called? Come on. It's Pig Latin. So yes, indeed, it is Pig Latin. So Pig is a language for doing set-based operations. And in this movie database, I'm not going to try and read this whole script to you. That'd be a waste of everybody's time. But basically, we've got data on users and currencies and geographies. And we're going to join all this data together logically as sets. For database people, this is a really familiar concept. And in this example, there's an interesting twist to the data because this company has the data broken down by countries for international data, but by states for US-based data. And so we've got to split the data into two different groups according to whether it's international or domestic US. I don't even know what that's about. And then we're going to do grouping and aggregation of the data based on countries for one set or based on states for a different set. And then we're going to go and put it all back together into one result set. And this is the sort of stuff that PIG is really good at, you know, cleansing and manipulating large volumes of data in set-based operations, which as relational database people, we get that. I mean, we're all over this stuff. So this is PIG, and when So then when I go and execute that script, I do this in a command shell. You can, if you look at this, you can see, for example, up here is evidence that it is actually running a MapReduce job. Now, it actually ran, I think, 5 MapReduce jobs to execute that workflow that I described. But here's probably the last of the MapReduce jobs being executed. The output of all that work was to produce 53 records, but a huge volume of data got summarized and aggregated and grouped to create this result. So there were 53 records in the result set. And then also using the PIG shell, I do some command shell-like things. Those of you who have at some time been Linux or Unix users will recognize things, you know, like ls on a directory and cat to see the contents of a file. These will look real familiar to some of you. So that result of that PIG job was summarized in a file. It was stored back in HDFS. And so if I cat the file, then I can see the contents of that output. Now, this isn't a super interesting way to look at it, and we'll see a better way to look at it a little later on in the talk. But the other thing, the other language that you need to know about is called Hive. Actually, it's called HiveQL is the query language. And in Hive, you do two things. There are literally data definition statements, DDL. Sounds familiar, right, for us relational folks. In Hive DDL, you're describing files that are out there in HDFS somewhere. You're saying, this is the location of a file. For example, here's a file in the states directory. We're saying this file has delimited fields separated by commas, and these are the names of the fields, and these are the data types. And now Hive will remember that for me so that I can create queries against this file. Once that's done, I can write statements. I think I said this before, but it's remarkably SQL-like statements. I mean, select title, count of IP as purchase count from purchase, join media on. I mean, this is SQL, right? We should be very comfortable working with this language. And that was a conscious choice, of course, on the part of the Hive developers. They wanted to make it tractable to as big of an audience as possible. But again, when I run a Hive job, it gets compiled into MapReduce. So the Hive language is translated to a MapReduce job. That gets run on my Hadoop cluster. And then I can do a select. So that query that I ran actually put its output in another Hive table, meaning a file. And then I did a select star from title counts, which is the name of that file, and I can see the data that was out there in that file. So it's an important concept to realize that underneath these higher level tools that we're using are still MapReduce jobs and either HDFS or Azure storage. Okay, so let's go back. I hope that was a reasonable way to give a demo, in considering that the real thing is busted right now. Next I want to talk about some ways to think about architecture in this ecosystem. And there's actually a lot of ways you could think about architecture, but I'm going to talk about three in particular that I think are kind of interesting, and probably especially to this audience. The first one is to think about the idea that we build OLTP applications and we build data warehouse applications, and we have historically built these on top of an ACID database, right? Everybody knows what I mean by ACID, right? Anybody who doesn't? Okay, so for the few that were brave enough to raise their hands, ACID stands for atomicity, consistency, independence, and durability. And those are the key properties of a relational database, right? Every relational database should have those properties. And those properties were defined for the transaction-based world. Now, those of us who are using relational databases for data warehousing, we already know there's some compromises when you take an ACID database and use it for data warehousing. So how many of you run your databases with minimal logging, right? Yeah, okay, quite a few. And then I figure it's probably twice that many because some of you didn't raise your hands. How many of you drop your indexes when you're going to load data and then recreate your indexes afterwards because it's faster than, yeah, okay, a bunch. So we know there's some compromises. In general, they're worth it, right? Because these are great tools. SQL Server is a great database, and we like working in that environment. But in the open source community, the mindset is a little different. They said, well, we'll build a special purpose tool for read-only databases, and that's called Hive. And we'll build a different tool for a transactional database, and that's called HBase. Well, there's another one called Cassandra. Actually, there's a bunch of them. So they decided they weren't interested in that compromise. They wanted a different tool for different contexts. By the way, BASE is another acronym which stands for Basically Secure Soft State and Eventually Consistent. And it's a different way of thinking about database technology. It's a different core concept of what a database is all about. So that's one way of thinking about architecture and some of the differences between what's happening in the open source world and what's happening in the relational world that we're familiar with. Another way that I like to think about the differences in these two worlds is to think about the basic properties that we've come to expect from SQL Server and other relational databases, and compare that to what's out there in the Hadoop world. So again, SQL Server is an ACID database. I mean, this is a rock solid tool for doing high value transaction processing. We also have a very highly evolved tool set. And we've got tools that are really great for managing the database and querying the database and doing graphical graphical displays, you know, of our data. A sophisticated, evolved tool set. We run it on enterprise-grade hardware. We run with high-quality servers. We, you know, mirrored or RAID arrays for our storage. And we're used to investing in that hardware and getting really good stuff because we want it to be reliable. And SQL Server is a very efficient database. It does not waste very many cycles, believe me. It is a very highly tuned system, especially compared to what we see in the open source world. Now, in the open source world, we've got a different set of advantages, a different set of properties. And as I mentioned, Hive is a read-only database. You can add more data into it, but once data is there, you really can't change it. If you want to change something, you toss the file and replace it with a new one. So it's a different concept of what it means to maintain a data warehouse. It is, however, massively scalable storage. I mean, we're not just talking about terabytes, we're talking about potentially petabytes and tens of petabytes of data that can be put in a Hadoop cluster if you just decide to put enough nodes and enough disks in your cluster. You just keep adding more and it just keeps growing. You know, wheel in more racks and there you go, a bigger cluster. So it's a different way of thinking about growth than we're used to in the relational world today. It is, as I've mentioned, a rapidly evolving ecosystem. There's a lot happening here. It changes all the time. You really have to work at it to keep up with everything that's going on. And then there's this notion of schema flexibility. You'll hear hype in the big data community about no schema needed, right? I don't have to worry about schema. I just put data in my cluster. And that's true. You can just put data in the cluster, and it'll be there in the cluster. But I argue that it's actually more of a pay me now or pay me later kind of situation. Because sooner or later, you want to do something with that data. And guess what? To do anything useful with the data, you've got to understand what's there. You've got to see what it means and what the data types are. So really, the more accurate way to think about this, I believe, is schema on write versus schema on read. So we're used to working in the SQL world, which is a schema on write world. We define our schema and we put data into that schema. So it's already schematized and organized as it's stored. But in the schema on read world, as I've been starting to say, the data is just out there. And when I want to use the data, then I come along and I describe the data in my MapReduce job or in my PIG job or in my Hive queries. So sometime you gotta face up to the fact that you gotta describe and work with that data. So it's really a question of schema on read versus schema on write. The argument for schema on read is that it's faster to get your system set up. It's faster to get your data in there. And that's true. It just means that you're going to be, you know, redefining that schema every time you want to use it. I'm not saying one's better or worse, but we just got to be fair about what the distinction is. So here's an example. Schema on read in Hive query. And I've kind of already walked through this, but I'm going to do it one more time just to be sure it's clear. There is a file out there in the file system in HDFS already, and that is a customer file. And what I'm doing here is I'm saying to Hive, there's a file out there. This is what its contents look like. So this is my DDL over here on the left-hand side. And once I've defined the DDL that maps onto these files, then I can run my SQL-like queries in Hive query language. You know, I can execute my DML statements. And then I can do things that, again, will look very familiar. Select, from, join, where, group, order by. So you can't tell me there's no schema involved in this. I'm sorry. It's there. It really is. PIG is not a lot different, except unless you're using HCatalog, you have to provide your schema every time you run a PIG job. So in this case, I've actually got a workflow that's going to use three different files, an orders file, a customer table, and a nation table, and it's going to do some grouping and aggregation on this data. So all of the stuff that's not circled is metadata or schema. And the stuff in the circle is the actual logic of the operations I was trying to do. So I just want to make sure people understand what's really happening when people say schema on read versus schema on write. But remember, underneath both PIG and Hive and a lot of the other tools that you'll be using, what's really happening is MapReduce jobs are being written and executed on your behalf. So here in the slightly bold text, I've written a very simple Hive query. And then you can see the system is telling me about its execution of the MapReduce jobs. This query actually got turned into two MapReduce jobs. I think one to do the join and one to do the, oh wait, there's no join. One to do the summarization, one to do the group by. So it took two steps of MapReduce jobs to execute this query, and then it produced a little output at the bottom. It's really important to remember that these are not going to be quick running queries. You know, you're not going to get sub-second response time out of Hive. You know, that would be the wrong expectation to come to the party with. This is going to take a little while to run, but the great thing is that no matter how big my data set is, it scales. So I think that's enough about that. So another way to think about architecture then is how do we build complete systems? Now, those of us who are in data warehouse or BI teams, we typically draw our picture of the world with the data warehouse in the middle, right? So over on the left, there's typically operational systems, you know, my transaction database, my HR system, my customer management, and other sources. Commonly, data will be pulled in through a staging area, managed by ETL flows, and I'll create a database, a data warehouse. And then sometimes I'll create data marts that are subsets of the data warehouse, and I'll create OLAP cubes. But on the right-hand side, eventually, is all the people who use this data. They're the people who read the reports that got generated, or they'll sit in front of dashboards on their computers, even better, the data analysts or the BI analysts or the data scientists will sit there and use their interactive tools to explore the data. And this is the world that we've all kind of gotten accustomed to. Now, there's many ways that architectures will change. Just like this isn't the only architecture for a data warehouse. There's a lot of ways that these things will happen. But here's one example of how data flows might work in a more Hadoop-oriented world. So we would have our transactional sources, our external data sources, and that data will be pulled in and stored in HDFS, very likely using the Flume tool. If the data is coming from the relational database, it could be pulled in using Scoop. But in either case, it's going to be stored in HDFS. Logically, we have a data warehouse then in HDFS. If we just create that metadata using Hive, we can then run queries against this data. We might also, depending on the application, the company, have a transaction processing system based on HBase. It's also out there stored in HDFS. We might have pig jobs that do data aggregation or cleansing or other kinds of preparation and keep the data, again, inside of HDFS. Then we might very well have what I'm now calling the presentation database, but that could equally well still be called the data warehouse. And we probably use Scoop to pull data out. And why do we do that? I mean, with as amazing as HDFS and as Hadoop is supposed to be, why do we then pull data out? Well, it's because we want interactive query performance, right? We've got users who expect to be able to ask questions and get an answer right now. And that's not what Hadoop does, right? So what we want to do is take all this learning, all this aggregated and cleansed and prepared data, and put it in a place where we're going to give users the kind of response time they expect. And the other thing is that, at least today, all the tooling isn't there to connect the front-end tools that we want to use to Hadoop. And so some of the tools will only work against our relational databases today. This is going to be a changing world. Don't think for a minute that a year from now this slide would still look the same. More of the tools will connect directly into Hadoop. Hadoop will have other functionality. And also, we're seeing a trend in the marketplace where there are federated query systems that will operate across both Hadoop storage, usually in the form of Hive, and your relational databases. And so we can expect, you know, more continual synthesis of these two worlds together. It's not going to be an either or. It's going to be using each for what it does best, and having an integrated view of the world across everything. So that's another way of thinking about architecture. I think that was the last one. Yeah. So now let's take a minute and talk about what Microsoft is doing in the big data space. Again, I'm not making any announcements. I'm giving you some general ideas so you can think about what we're doing and kind of construct your mental roadmap of what you want to do in response. So the first thing you need to understand is that Microsoft has a very close partnership with Hortonworks to bring Hadoop to Windows. Hortonworks is they're one of the biggest companies that has come out of the open source community to provide support for companies that don't want to just venture out and do their own, you know, roll your own implementation of Hadoop. So you can get support, you can get a Hortonworks distribution of Hadoop, and working with us, they're producing an implementation of Hadoop for Windows. And I say that as almost as if it was a port, but in fact what they're doing is they're building the support for Windows into Hadoop so that Windows is a first-class supported operating system in Hadoop, just like Linux is today. And so you could go out and you could do a roll your own implementation of Hadoop on Windows once all that work is done. So we've got a very close working relationship with Hortonworks, bringing Hadoop to Windows. But it's not just to Windows as you know, Windows servers running on a server farm. We're also bringing Hadoop to the cloud. So Hadoop will run on Windows Azure in the cloud. And in fact, that demo that I tried to do was a Hadoop on Azure demo. I hope that was clear as we talked about it. So that would have run completely in the cloud. So this means that whether you want to run your own deployment or whether you want to put your data in the cloud and take advantage of those economies, you can get the best of both worlds there. So that's the first thing, you know, is just getting Hadoop to run on Windows. That's a vital first step. But you know that Microsoft is the kind of company that we want to make our tools easy for everybody to use. We don't want people spending their lives getting, you know, building clusters of machines and managing, you know, through crufty interfaces. So Microsoft is going to, when Microsoft's offering comes to market, there will be simple setup and management and reporting tools so you can understand what's happening in your clusters, you can set them up efficiently, you can manage them, you can maintain them. If a node fails, you can replace it, you'll get reports to tell you what's going on, all that sort of thing. You should expect that from Microsoft, and I think that's what you'll see in the near future when our Hadoop for Windows system comes out. The other thing that you should expect from Microsoft is connectivity to the kinds of tools that we know and love in the data warehousing and BI world. You know, if you're going to put data in Hadoop, you want to know that you can get that data into SQL Server, that you can build analysis services cubes on it, that you can run reports on it with reporting services, that your Excel users can pull data into their spreadsheets. And you should expect all of that to be provided by Microsoft in our Hadoop distributions. So in another sense, you're benefiting from the best of both worlds, too. You've not only got the on-premises or cloud worlds, but you've also got the Hadoop ecosystem and the Windows and SQL Server ecosystem. And you get the best of both worlds there as well. And to that end, I would like to do another really quick demo, in quotes. This one also is a cloud-based demo, although of course Excel's running on my machine in my office. But the Azure cluster, or the Hadoop cluster is in Azure in the cloud. So there's a little Excel add-in, HiveODBC, that you can download from the Azure website. And when you add that add-in, so to speak, on your data pane, there's a Hive connector pane that is available now. And when you click on the Hive connector, you do, in fact, get a pane like this. And if I go and enter my cluster details, I actually see that this screenshot wasn't complete. The form wasn't completely filled out when I snapped the screenshot. I would actually enter my cluster name here, lenwy.cloudapp.net, I think it was. Anyway, then I give my authentication information, and I OK that. And now all of the tables that are defined through Hive in that Hadoop cluster are now available to me as an Excel user. And the one that I've selected here is the GeoSummary table that I created with the pig job in the earlier demo. But it's that the output of that pig job that I did, that did the aggregations by states and countries. And I can choose to have various filter criteria, and I can aggregate and group the data. But in this case, I'm just going to pull the data exactly as it is. So I'll execute that query. And this is the data that was generated by that pig job. It's now been pulled out of Hadoop in the cloud and placed in my spreadsheet. And once I've done that, then I can create a power pivot, I love Power Pivot as an analytical tool, or pivot tables in general. I can now start creating pivot tables and work with this data and eventually produce a display that might be very meaningful to my business users. And as promised in the earlier discussion, I've got my data aggregated, you know, by countries, for the countries where this company does business, and then by states in the United States. This fictitious company doesn't do any business in New Zealand, apparently. But I just pulled the data set. I didn't make it up. Okay. So then just a couple more words before we wrap up. So the research company, IDC, late last year put out a report, and they said that big data will earn its place as the next must-have competency in 2012. And if you look at the hype that's out there in the marketplace, it certainly is looking that way. And judging by the number of people that have come to this session, I think you probably are seeing it that way too. So given that you are here and you're interested in this stuff, what should you be learning about? And the answer is, it depends on what your role is. You know, if you're in operations, you want to think about things like cluster management. How do I deploy and monitor and repair and upgrade my cluster? It's exactly analogous to an operations job today, right? You want to think about things like data stewardship. You know, if I'm going to put all this data in my cluster, how do I know what's there? How do I make sure it's safe and the right people have access to it? You want to think about security. How do I know it's safe and the right people have access to it? You want to think about, how will I provide and manage for workflows? As I mentioned before, there's data ingestion steps that happen before data aggregation steps, and maybe data cleansing fits in there somewhere. How do I manage those workflows? On the other hand, if you're a business analyst or a data analyst or a data scientist, you're going to want to focus more on the analytic tools. Obviously, there's the basic tools, you know, HDFS itself and Hive and Pig. You'll need to know those things. But if you're doing more statistic-oriented work, you'll probably want to know about R, which is a language for data analysis and statistics. If you're working more in the presentation layer, then the tools are probably going to be real familiar to you from what you use today, Excel and analysis services and reporting services. If you're doing machine learning and data mining kinds of things, then the chances are that in this new ecosystem, you'll use Mahout instead of using analysis services data mining. If you're a developer, you kind of need to know about all of these things because, you know, the tools in the Hadoop ecosystem are kind of a developer's dream, right? They're just done enough so the developer can do what he needs to do. But I guess I would say that unless you're a developer, today at least, a lot of these tools are less than a dream. You know, as I work with Pig and Hive, you know, when I make a mistake, it's very likely that my error message is a stack dump. And so there's a lot of advantage of these tools, but they're not the sophisticated, evolved tools that we've been used to working with. And so you'll probably have a lot closer relationship on a day-to-day basis with developers than you have in the past. So if you are a developer, then you kind of need to know a little bit about all these tools and how this whole Java-based ecosystem works, you know, what a jar file is and how you execute and how all these things hold together. So those are some of the things that you'd want to think about going looking for as you venture into this space, depending on what your role is. So where would you look? Okay. So the first thing you got to remember is that this all came from the open source community. So this information is out there on the web. Now, we're used to doing things like going to MSDN and TechNet to finding our information. And it's a little less organized than that in the open source world. You're going to have to search. You're going to use Bing, of course, but you're going to have to search for this stuff. But there are a few things I want to particularly point you to. For an overview of how this stuff works, of what MapReduce is really all about, and how HDFS works, there's a really great talk by Dr. DeWitt from the University of Wisconsin. He delivered this at the PASS conference last year. And by the way, all his talks are wonderful. If you've got a few minutes, go look at his other talks too. They're wonderful, wonderful talks. But in his most recent PASS talk, he talked about the Hadoop architecture and it explained how it works in a way that is just amazingly easy to grasp. It's a really golden presentation. I'd recommend looking at that. There's a couple of other things. The definitive source for how Hive works is the Hive language manual. It's on the Apache website. And the definitive source for Pig Latin is the Pig Latin Reference Manual 2, which is also on the Apache website. But if you're not careful, you'll accidentally find the Pig Latin Reference Manual, period. And there's a lot of stuff that's been added to Pig Latin since the original manual was written. So be sure you use the reference manual too if you're looking for information on Pig Latin. There are some good books out there. I personally have Hadoop, the Definitive Guide. I like it. It is a little bit of a programmer-oriented book, but if you kind of skip past that a little bit and get up to the good stuff, it's a pretty good book. Programming Pig by Alan Gates. I don't personally have it, but I know people who do, and they say it's a really good book. There's another book, Programming Hive, which is coming out in just a few days, and the early reviews on that one are pretty good. I don't mean to dismiss other books about Hadoop and the ecosystem, but these are the ones that I've had really good recommendations for. There is commercial training that's available. Today I would tend to think Hortonworks University is probably the best place to go. Cloudera also does a lot of training. And again, in this kind of gold rush mentality, there are a lot of companies that are coming to do training. But if you're thinking about using the Microsoft distribution of Hadoop, I would tend to think that Hortonworks is the place to go. And if you're a data analyst role, there's some interesting third-party analytical tools, KarmaSphere and Datamere. I don't really have time to talk about them today, but might be worth taking a look at those, if you're in an analyst role. So after all this, there's a bunch of takeaways. There's a bunch of thoughts you might have about the Hadoop ecosystem. Yes, it's big. Yes, it's a mess. Yes, it's exciting. Yes, it's confusing. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of potential here to do things at a scale that we just wouldn't have conceived of a few years ago. As we've got these exploding volumes of data and new types of data that are not relational in format, this is an opportunity to do things that just would have been inconceivable before now. So I hope that having heard this, you'll have some interest to go ahead, look up some of this information, learn more about Hadoop, sign up for a trial using Hadoop on Azure, watch in the coming months as we start to do previews of the Hadoop on-premises on Windows implementations as well. So thank you for your time. I'm guessing there are probably some questions, but also there's going to be another session wanting to come in. So we'll step outside, and I will hang around and answer questions for hopefully as long as you all want to talk. But we've got to let the next session come in. So thanks very much.